Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, travel writer Paul Theroux on the enchantments and the terrors of contemporary Mexico. Now in his late 70s, Theroux is as mentally agile as ever, but worried he might be approaching the day when his eyesight wasn't good enough to undertake a long journey behind the wheel of his own car. So he set out from his home in Massachusetts, first dipping back and forth along the southern border and then remaining well past it to find his way to Oaxaca and Chiapas. We'll talk about the people he met along the way and how they surprised him, and about modern Mexico's unique mixture of warm hospitality and sincere and urgent warnings to strangers passing through. Our conversation starts after a short break. Paul Theroux's most recent trip through Mexico, he felt warmly welcomed by the people he met, people more than patient with his less than perfect Spanish and eager to invite him into their homes and around their tables. But those welcomes often came with warnings, the kind of warnings that become necessary for strangers when organized crime syndicates claim huge swaths of territory and law enforcement officers are venal at best and fully in league with the bad guys at worst. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Mexico is not an easy place to sum up. It's too geographically and culturally diverse, too multilingual, too big and messy and beautiful. It is a country defined by overt reminders of mortality, and one that made Paul Theroux, travel writer and novelist, feel more fully alive than he had in years. His new book is called On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. Paul, welcome back to Think.
It's great to be here, Chris.
You write that Mexico is not a country, it's a world unto itself.
It really is a world unto itself, and it's sort of old-fashioned to think that you can sum up a place. People say, actually, there's a woman called Leonora Carrington who said living in Mexico is like being in a lovely swimming pool with some sharks in it. So I don't know, that's simplistic. But since Mexico was in the news a few years ago, actually, our president making robust statements about stereotyping Mexicans, and Mexico is our neighbor, I thought I would write about it, write about the border. It's with Canada, the only place that an American can walk down the street, go through a door, and suddenly be in another country. And that, for a traveler, especially for me, I've traveled in a lot of countries. I've written 11 travel books, but the idea that I could just go next door and drive there, which is what I did, was very attractive. Not to sum up Mexico, but to do what a traveler should do, which is destroy the stereotype, show that there's a lot of different people, a lot of things happening, and that the landscape, the culture, the food, the people, that it's various, and for me, it was wonderful.
I wonder if we feel that we know Mexico well enough that we don't actually notice the way it changes.
I think it's a problem but it's true of a lot of, I used to live in England, and people used to come to England and say, well, we had tea, and then we went to Wimbledon. And I say, there's a lot of crime in England. There's a lot of soccer hooligans. Not everyone goes to Wimbledon. It's tough. Taxes are high. It's hard to pass your driving tests. People live very small. They live in very tiny. Everyone's a tight fit,
yeah.
As Henry James once said. They're a tight fit in England. And to come here and go see, they'd say, did you see Phantom of the Opera? I said, no, I didn't. I was doing my taxes or my VAT or whatever. So I wasn't. But so I lived there for a long time, and I thought, you know, when people come to a place, they think they can sum it up. Oh, we had a wonderful time. You went to Mexico? We had tacos. We had mojitos. Have you tried the mezcal? People are so nice. The waiters were so nice. And I think, well, I didn't go to the tourist places. I actually went to places. I was determined, actually, to go up and down the border and then to go to places where people are leaving, villages in the Mixteca Alta, in the mountains that are only accessible by a four-wheel. Mine's an all-wheel drive car, where I could actually drive there, live there for a while, talk to people and ask them, why are you going to the States? And many people had come back, and some villages had a tradition of going to a particular town in America. Poughkeepsie, for example. There's a town called San Agustin Yataremi where half the people are in Poughkeepsie. So that's not on the tourist route, but it's for if you're writing a book, you know, it's something to write about.
I can't get out of my head the encounters you had with people in Oaxaca who were making their living by weaving these hats, because I haven't traveled extensively through Mexico, but I've been there several times and you'll see people on the street selling hats. And I'd just never given much thought to the fact that there's a person making each hat for hours at a time who may be only making a few cents, maybe a dollar per 20, piece.
25 cents. Yeah. Actually, well, the equivalent of 25 cents. That was a town where a town where that's Ixcatlan, where they there are several things that happen. Well, they weave hats, they make mezcal, and they weave baskets. But that town, no one has money there. They would say, as Thomas Hart Benton, the painter, once said, "I'm not poor. I just don't have any money." Hmm. And these people. They lived through making things and bartering them. So they would a woman would wake up in the morning, usually a woman rather than a man, and weave a hat and take the corn kernels down to the molino, down to the mill, and say, "Here's my hat. Here's 25 cents. Will you mill my the corn into flour?" And they'd say, "Yeah, okay." They take the hat. The business, you say, here's a hat, can I have a candy bar or something, whatever, or two candy bars. So the hats are then taken further afield and they're sold in the market. But hats was a sort of currency. Hmm. And so you hadn't come across it. But a hat sold in Cancun, for example, or Mazatlan, might come from that village, which was currency.
You are adamant to remind us that there are many cultures and many languages in Mexico. There are lots of, you met a number of people for whom Spanish was their second language as well, because they speak an indigenous language first.
Yeah, well, there's a town called San Baltazar Guelavilla, and most of the people in that town spoke Zapoteco. And They said it's our secret language. We can talk with each other, and no one will know what we're saying. It was, they loved it. They studied it in school, Zapotec. Well, Zapotec has been spoken in Mexico for thousands of years, and the idea that Spanish was a second language for these people. So, their thinking, their literature, their stories, were a Zapotec. Well, the Zapotecs were in Monte Alban. Which is the oldest city in the Western Hemisphere. And so the tradition, the idea that Mexicans have this link with the past is a very attractive thing and an amazing thing. I'm part Native American. My ancestors came from the north of Wisconsin, the Menominee people. They have a link of 6,000 years when they were there. But they've lost a lot of their language, not all of it, but there are still people who speak it. But the idea that you have this could be called the visitable past. The idea that you can visit that past, hear the stories, that's an aspect of Mexico. I'm not romanticizing it, or the poverty, but the idea that it's something to be reckoned with, and there are hundreds of languages that are spoken, of native language, traditional languages that are spoken in Mexico too.
You wanted to see if you could visit Huichol village, and were told that they were just so tired of like Americans showing up and trying to proselytize and preach to them that they sort of made it hard for outsiders to visit.
Yeah, the Huicholes are a people who live near a town called Tepic, and it's near Puerto Vallarta. It's in the mountains above it. Actually, it was visited by D.H. Lawrence, not the Huicholes, but that area, and by a British travel writer called Norman Lewis, who tried to visit and was rebuffed. Well, I admire people. You know, I wrote a book about the Pacific, the Happy Isles of Oceania, and in Vanuatu, I remember meeting people in the islands of Vanuatu, and they were saying, they said every so often a missionary comes, and I said, "What do you do?" They said, "We listen, and then we tell them to go away." You know, the idea that a missionary comes and says, you're born in sin. Remember that you are born in sin and you have to repent. And that is bad news for if you get you're a happy people. You have your traditional gods and whatever and beliefs, and then someone comes and says, "You're not going to get to heaven unless you read this book," which is the Holy Bible, is not something I recommend. But I've all my life. I mean, I joined the Peace Corps in 1963, and all my life I've come across missionaries who think that they know the truth, and you know, they don't.
You speak Spanish. You took a class at one point to improve your Spanish. How easy was it for you to have a conversation, and when would you find yourself? Were you ever lost in conversation?
I was lost in conversation. See, I taught writing. I thought I need friends. So I drove to Mexico. I mean, I think that the listeners might be interested to know that I got in my car in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and drove to McAllen, Texas, and then went up and down the border in my car. And then I went to Reynosa, Monterrey, Saltillo. And I thought I need friends. So I taught a class in writing in Mexico City, just a volunteer. I said, don't pay me, and you don't have to pay anything, but be my friend and help me improve my Spanish. So the answer to the question is, I have functional Spanish. I can go anywhere and say anything. But to have a conversation with very, very good writers, which they were, published writers in some cases, requires a subtlety that I don't have. And an ability, you know, the subjunctive tense, which I don't have. But then a lot of Americans have a problem with the subjunctive tense. I would have done it.
Right.
You know, I could have done it. Why wouldn't he? You know, this woulda, coulda. Americans have a problem with it. So subjunctive, no. But the rest of it, yeah, I could get along. And then it was fun being a student, you know, at my age, being in Oaxaca at the Institute and going to class every day. It's very exhausting being a student. I had forgotten that. It's also, if you're at a language class, you have to reveal a lot of yourself. You know, the teacher says, "So what did you do when you were a small boy? And what sports do you like? And why do you like them? And tell us about your relatives." And I'm there.
So you made stuff up a couple times.
Yeah, I did. I had to, because I felt it. You reveal so much. I mean, students reveal it. So a teacher can get to know a student and your fellow students, too. And I thought, I make a living explaining myself in writing. So I suppose that's part of the territory.
It is interesting to think about, though, learning a language, you know, and being asked just by way of making conversation to reveal things about yourself. And then, of course, you're also so vulnerable. You, as you said, have very functional Spanish. But for people who are just starting out in a new language, it's often embarrassing, you know, as you're making mistakes to learn.
Yes, that's true. But all travel should make a person understand how small they are in the world, how small, and how humble they should be. So a language class teaches humility. And also, as a writer, you know, they say, you know, esta muñeca, this is a doll. Tell us a story about this doll. Well, as a writer, I tell stories. So in Spanish, I could say, well, here's a doll. Let me tell you about where this doll comes from. So I could improvise a story about a doll in a way that, you know, another student might not be able to do. It's my living, making up stories. So that was fun. But I did find it a challenge. And those are good for someone my age. And it was very helpful. To be in Mexico and not speak Spanish is very limiting. You need to learn Spanish and you need to read a lot. I don't know whether you noticed, but my book is full of other
references books, to other writers.
Other writers. Yeah, I mean, tons of them. Tons of them. I mean, one I came across, Rebecca West, English writer. She wrote a book called Black Wolf and Grey Falcon about Yugoslavia. It's 400,000 words. Well, she was going to do the same thing in Mexico. So the remnants of her book that she never finished are well worth reading. Then Graham Greene, Evelyn Waugh, D.H. Lawrence, you know, Malcolm Lowry, all those wonderful writers. And it goes back to the 16th century, the writers say.
My guest is writer Paul Theroux. We're talking about his newest book, On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist and travel writer Paul Theroux. His new book is On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. All right, Paul, I want to talk about the gringo factor. You remind us that the term doesn't necessarily carry malice in Mexico. There's another term, gabacho, which is a little more derogatory. What is the difference, and how does a gringo in Mexico avoid being a gabacho in Mexico?
Gabacho is a disparaging term. In Spain, it means French person. But I learned the word on the border. I was actually in Ciudad Alemán, and a man said, we were just talking in general about word, the way you do if you're trying to learn a language, use it as much as possible. And he said, but you're not a gabacho. I said, so to explain it. It's a rough at the edges. It's an unpleasant gringo. But a gringo, that's an all-purpose term for a foreigner, and particularly from someone north of the border. We live in Gringolandia and gringo. But I said in the book how there's a social interaction called a joking relationship where a Mexican will tease you for being a gringo. And this teasing is a sanctioned interaction where they say gringos do that, and gringos, well, you're a gringo. And you're allowed to be teased. You have to be a good sport about it. And you can tease back, too. But teasing, in sociological term, teasing is quite a friendly thing. It can be a very friendly thing. It can be wicked, too. But in Mexico, often it's an interaction that leads to friendship. True friendship in Mexico comes from earning respect, actually doing something. So you're a gringo, but you're not a good gringo. You're an acceptable gringo, but you're not a good gringo until you've sort of proven yourself. One respect, ganar el respeto. And when that happens in Mexico, you have a friend for life. You have someone who will have your back, introduce you to people that they trust you with, and you can get along. And this is why my trip lasted 2 years. But midway through the trip, I began to understand that not only did I need friends, but that you really don't understand Mexico unless you have friends. On the border, the border is different. The border is a very ill-assorted. You know, you could be on the border and you talk about migrants, but the migrants might be Chinese tycoons who pay a cartel $50,000 to be led through a tunnel or under a fence, and those are migrants. There are migrants from Nigeria. There are ones from Syria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. The jails in Arizona with migrants are full of what are called special interest aliens. And they're referring to gringo. They're not gringos. Those are people who are kind of unclassifiable. But they're circulating all over Mexico. So Mexico's full of other people, of special interest aliens, not the caravans from Central America. Those are, you know, a lot of people fleeing misery. But someone from China with a lot of money, or India, who can afford to get to Mexico, is someone else to be reckoned with. And you see a lot of them in Texas. You see them all in Arizona. And it's not until you traveling on both sides of the border that you see that the border isn't one place, it's many. And in terms of crossing, hundreds of thousands of people, Mexicans mostly, cross it every day to work in El Paso. I met people who worked in used car lots. They lived in Juarez. They came across every day, walked across rather than drove because it's more efficient. People making tacos in, you know, Eagle Pass or in McAllen, back and forth. Every day there's this huge numbers of people just filing through immigration to work and then going back at night. That's not true of Pakistanis, the Indians, the Nigerians. So it's but that you don't understand. And as I said, I was in my car. I got to McAllen. I drove to Tijuana. I actually drove to San Isidro and went across. And I went from west to east after that. And only then did I go to Reynosa and south. And of course, I mean, I was reminded all the time that I'm a gringo, but not disparaged for it. But as I said, it wasn't till I proved that I don't know that I respected Mexicans, and that teaching was one way, teaching for nothing, and saying, you know, I've got the heart and soul of a Peace Corps volunteer. I'm going to come and I'm going to do this. And that I found that it was reciprocated, and it won me not only friends, but I ended up in Chiapas talking to Subcomandante Marcos, the head of the Zapatistas, who was a friend of a friend of a friend, and I got to know, got fairly intimate with the Zapatistas, which to me was the reward, a reward for, I don't know, soldiering on and doing my bit.
One of the things that impressed you about the Zapatistas was that, unlike other groups that have been fighting for different things sort of against the prevailing governments of their regions, is that the Zapatistas do not do any acts of terrorism that would ever affect an innocent person.
Or
they try not to.
Yeah, they don't kill civilians. I lived in England at a time when the IRA were setting off bombs, and they often killed civilians. I mean, there were collateral damage, they might say. But if you set off a bomb in a market square in Northern Ireland, you're bound to kill 15 or 20 civilians. And 5,000 people died in the so-called Troubles. It wasn't just the IRA. It was all the UDF, the Protestant. But they routinely killed civilians. And ETA in Spain killed civilians. The Tupamaros killed civilians. Zapatistas make a point. It's like a postmodern revolutionary group, that they build clinics, they have schools, they have the villages they call caracoles. Caracol is a snail, mm-hmm. And so it's kind of an interesting way of thinking of a village. But I went to the villages, the Zapatista villages. I was really impressed by how well run they were, and. Not oppressively, but in a very democratic way. The schools were brilliant. I mean, if you go to a school in Juarez, for example, across from El Paso, you could go to a colonia, a community, where there's 250,000 people and there might be one high school. Well, this is NAFTA. This is what NAFTA does. It employs people, offers them very low salaries. People live in very humble conditions and likely not to go. The kids probably won't go to school. That's different. So I have been accused by some reviewers of being sweet on the Zapatistas, you know, that romanticize. I'm not romanticizing them. But the world needs more people who refuse to kill civilians, who are engaged in social work, and who make sacrifices. When Fidel Castro came out of the mountains and took over Cuba, he had only, you know, it was a very short revolution. He just came in. He didn't develop intimate relationships with ordinary Cubans till after he got to power. The Zapatistas were 11 years in the Lacandon jungle of Chiapas, learning the language, finding out what people wanted, and only then January 1st, 1994, when NAFTA began, they came out of the jungle and they said, here's what we're going to do. This is who we are and this is what we're going to do. The Mexican army attacked them, and they fought back. But they haven't, there's been no fighting. It's a standoff at the moment. But I admire people who make sacrifices and who live humbly with other people. I feel, you know, I try to do that myself in my writing. But it was the fact that I had made friends that allowed me to see what the Zapatistas were doing.
You say that no matter how charming the downtown, how picturesque the plaza or the cathedral, or how amazing the food in any Mexican city, there is a fundamental grimness to everyday life, and you blame that on bad governance.
It's bad governance. It's also, you know, if you read the New York Times, couple of back issues, you discover that Walmart wanted to build a depot and a big store in a historical district of Mexico City. And through a lot of backhanders, through government or local authorities, Walmart managed to establish itself in Mexico City and to violate a sacred place. So you go to the average or fairly large Mexican city has a Walmart. They also have, you know, big box stores, but Walmart or Sam's Club. So you go to the center of Puebla, name a city, San Luis Potosí, or even Oaxaca, you're likely to find a kind of the pure horror of rampant capitalism and of people just, you know, selling Chinese goods through their store. And so that's the other layer of Mexico. There's another. So the center of a city has the Zócalo, the historic ancient center, and then the 500-year-old colonial center, and then at greater distances, the used car lots, the Walmart. And this goes without saying, the slums, whatever. But that's Mexico. And this is why it needs to be visited and written about, because we live in a complicated world, a world where there are a lot of people, some might say too many people, and it's crowds. And Mexico City has 23 million people. That's a lot of folks. And so the bad government, which you mentioned, is also a factor in Mexicans being, they're not exactly tolerant of our government, but they understand that governments tend to be crooked, tend to be not without much outreach for the ordinary citizen, that it's hard to get a pension in Mexico, for example. So mal gobierno, which is what Mexicans talk about, bad government, applies as much to them as to other people. So they don't decry Trump. They tend to decry their own government.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You did see a lot of Trump-shaped piñatas.
Yeah, nothing like a Trump-shaped piñata for venting your emotions. All along the border, they tend to be on the border, the curio shops and the piñatas. But I saw a Bernie Sanders piñata. I saw El Chapo piñatas. Yeah, that's true.
Talk about what you learned about Santa Muerte and her appeal. I guess is that she asks no repentance of the people who ask her for blessings.
Yeah, we should explain that Santa Muerte is holy death, a skeleton with a number of attributes. The hood, she's holding a staff and so forth, and she's the saint of the downtrodden, of the cartels, of the brothels, let's say, of the poor. She rejects no one. All you need to do is to believe in her, to believe in holy death. And then it's the fastest growing faith in Mexico. And there are chapels everywhere, some big, some small. And I said to my students in Mexico, they said, what do you want to do? I said, help me improve my Spanish, have lunch with me, be my friend. But also a couple of things I want to do. Zapatistas was one. And I said, come to the Chapel of Holy Death. They said, might be dangerous. I said, come on. Give me a break. Let's go. So we did. We mounted a little expedition and went to the thing. But you might say that in parts of Mexico, people are so desperate. They're so in need of help that they'll latch on to anything. And so to go to the Chapel of Holy Death, Santa Muerte, and get a relic or a little, you know, as you might in a Christian church, actually, to get a little a picture or a rosary or something or some beads and get it blessed. That it might help you. In my car, I had a Santa Muerte, a dangling skeleton, which I don't think impressed anybody, but I thought, for a believer, if a policeman stopped me and he was a believer, maybe he'd take pity on me. They didn't, though.
You had one encounter that was scary, even for a seasoned traveler like you, who sort of knew what to do when stopped by an aggressive police officer.
Yeah, someone pointed out to me the other day, an African-American, I was complaining about the police in Mexico who stopped me and then demanded $300 as a bribe. And I said, I don't have it. I told him in Spanish, you know, soy pensionado. I'm a pensioner. I'm a retired person. I'm old, obviously. He said, go to a bank, go to an ATM. I said, I don't have the money. And then I had to stick to my story. I did have $300, but I thought maybe I can barter him down or argue him down. That's a factor in Mexico that the police, many police, are corrupt. But this man said to me, this African-American said to me, but you were able to pay and get away. For an African-American who's stopped by a policeman in the States, it's not a question of money. We can't bribe, you can't bribe your way away. Because I was saying, poor me, I was at their mercy. And he said, imagine what it's like for an African-American stopped, he's got the gun, but he doesn't want money from you. He just wants to intimidate you or humiliate you. I said, well, the guy did want to humiliate me, but I bought my way out of it. It happened 4 times in Mexico. And I realize now that I was able, you know, I'm a fairly well-off older person, so I got the money. I hate bribing people. But nothing moves in India without a bribe. Go to India, buy something. You have to ship it. They say, well, there's this, but we'll need the bakshish for the customs people, and bakshish at the post office, and bakshish, and you say, well, okay, here's a bakshish. Nigeria, they call it a dash. You pay and pay and pay. You know, I suppose there's a lot of bribery in the States. Rod Blagojevich is in prison for something like it. So it exists. But in Mexico, if you're driving a car with Massachusetts license plates that say Massachusetts, Spirit of America, you're likely to be stopped and be told by the policeman that those are foreign plates. And he'll say to you, ¿Sabes lo que puedo hacerte? Do you know what I can do to you? Mm-hmm. And then you say, yeah, I can impound your car. I can take it. And you'll have to pay money to get it out. Better off, you just pay me and go on your way. So I did.
My guest is travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux. His new work of nonfiction is On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Paul Theroux. His new book is called On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. Paul, throughout your journey, people you met who knew where you were going and where you had come from had advice for you about places you should or should not go based on cartel activity. And it occurred to you that Americans aren't necessarily so kind to go out of their way as to warn an immigrant or a stranger from another country about places they should or should not go here.
That's very true. That's very interesting that you should say that, because I also think that there are huge communities of Americans, Canadians, Germans, whatever, in San Miguel de Allende, in Mazatlan, in Puerto Vallarta, in Yucatan. Very, very big communities of just all gringos. And it's very hard to think. We try to imagine a big community of Mexicans living, you know, name a place where there's they're all retired and they're all living and they're all happy and Americans are working for them. Let's say Americans are cleaning their houses and making their beds. That doesn't exist. So it's not reciprocated. I can't imagine someone stopping a Mexican and saying, by the way, be careful over there. There's a lot of policemen, or I don't know. You might get hassled. Don't drive at night. Whereas Mexicans constantly said to me, don't drive at night. Don't go to Guerrero State. It's outside Acapulco. They said Acapulco's okay, but elsewhere, you might have a problem. There's cartel. Even on the border, they say this town is okay. Usually their own town, they would say it's okay at this time of day. Reynosa, for example, which is right across from McAllen, is a very violent place at the moment. And a lot of Mexicans said, don't go there. Don't cross. The first time I crossed through Reynosa, I didn't know that. So it was just, you know, a fool's errand, I guess. But I didn't have a problem. But there are a lot of places to cross. I mean, into Texas, for example. Ciudad Alemán goes into Roma, Texas. Well, Roma's a lovely little town. It's a bit beat up, but Ciudad Alemán isn't beat up. It's actually got a lot going for it. It's very charming, beautiful place. Rio Grande City outside Roma is... Roma, by the way, is where Viva Zapata was made, was filmed. So you do get the warnings. You get it's a kindness that Mexicans have. They don't want to have a bad reputation. They don't want you to have a problem. I always listen to them. And since I was driving my own car, I needed to be careful. I drove at night now and then when I had to. But generally speaking, I stayed off the road. I found a place to stay. I gassed up the car and then would stay there. And then, you know, at dawn or, you know, after breakfast, I would move on. So I moved around during the day. Mexicans are very careful about warning people, though, and they know. I mean, as local people do, you know where you're likely to have a problem. I cannot imagine an American doing that. No.
You describe, on the one hand, a kind of resignation that many Mexicans have about poverty and crime and government corruption. And on the other hand, there is this very active political culture that when it decides to speak, people who are demonstrating do not speak softly. They're quite adamant about what they want to communicate. So how do you square those two things?
They live in a country full of contradictions. One is a lot of Mexican journalists have been killed. The number killed is very, very high. They're usually killed by either people in the government or people in cartels, people they've criticized. So a critic, a journalist, and they're very brave people too, object to something happening, whether it's a cartel or a crooked politician, and they speak out, and they often pay with their lives. It's one of the most dangerous places for a journalist. How do they square it? They've been defiant. Mexicans have been defiant first against the Spanish, and then they've been invaded twice by us. So they've been humiliated, and they realize that they have to fight back. That you need to be brave. You need to be resolute. Some take a different path. I mean, they shrug and they say, that's the way things are. We have to live with it. But many, quite rightly, object to the fact that there are criminal syndicates all over the country. And they object to that. But I think they should be admired for fighting at all, for objecting, because they don't get help from many other people. I mean, they're disparaged by our government. Mexicans, you know, seen as rapists and murderers and all that. And we have a very poor relationship with, considering that Mexico is a neighbor, we have a very poor relationship with, diplomatic relationship with the government. The border is a solvable issue, I would think, or more solvable if we regarded Mexico as a friend. And fighting the common fight, you know, or the common struggle against the border. The border needs to exist. It's a border, after all. But it needs to be secured, obviously, and it needs to be safer for people. And if you want to become an American, line up, take a number. It shouldn't be people walking across the desert or swimming across, you know, to wherever. So that's that obviously is a problem. But Mexicans, they fight back. They're defiant, and I admire that. The one thing about Mexico, the other thing I suppose, which is very important for someone my age, is that I'm respected there. Mm. That old age is respected in a way that it isn't in the States. An old person in the States is just an old croak. It's someone who's not going to buy the latest music, unlikely to buy the latest book. Marketing is not directed against older people. It's for the young. And the young kind of take this as their right. And so the old are not respected in the country, in this country, in the way that they are in other countries, Italy, for example, or Germany, or parts of Africa, or parts of South America, and certainly in Mexico. So one of the pleasures of being in Mexico as an older person is that you get respect just for your age. You're a, I'm an hombre de juicio. I'm a man of judgment, you know, and I'm respected for that. I'm Don Pablo. Well, that's very nice, especially nice if you're writing a book.
Was this something you understood when you were younger, the disrespect of the elderly in our culture?
No, I did not. I was raised to be very respectful of older people. I was born in Medford, Massachusetts, and the idea of calling an older person by their first name was just unthinkable. Unthinkable. No matter, it happens in doctor's offices all the time. They say for insurance purposes, you're not supposed to use a last name, but you could say sir or please sir or not. But the idea, no, I was raised to be so respectful. And it was part of my parents' upbringing. I come from a lower middle class family, but my father was always yes sir, no sir. And you get that in Texas. You hear sir used much more than in the North, where I come from. You don't say sir, but you wouldn't presume on an older person. You wouldn't. I mean, if an older person was standing nearby you and you were sitting, you'd give the person your seat, mm-hmm. whether on a bus or a train or in a room, you would never. But I was also raised in a large family where respect was, you know, I come from a family of seven children. If there's one cookie left on the plate, you're not going to grab. If there are seven children at the table and there's a cookie there, you're going to say, do you want that? Are you sure you don't want it? No, I don't want it. Are you sure? You're not going to be the one who takes the last cookie. So you need to be respectful to each other, too. That's out the window now, I'm afraid.
You write about going to Mexico at a time when you felt sort of diminished in status because of your age. And your time there really turned it around, and you started to, as you say, feel more alive than you had in years. Was it the travel or was it specific to Mexico? Was this something that couldn't have happened if you had gone to Argentina or France or anywhere else?
It was partly, I can tell you, the fact that it was a road trip. A road trip in Mexico was just bliss. But the idea of getting in a car in the morning and driving off into the sunshine, to me, makes me feel young. It makes me feel happy. I thought, this is how I want to live. I just loved it. So that lifted my spirits, just the fact that it was a long, long road trip that went over a couple of years. And whenever I thought, I left my car in Houston with a friend, and whenever I picked up the car and resumed my trip in Mexico, I was a happy man. I didn't feel old. I felt rejuvenated in the true sense of the words of made to feel young. The fact that it was Mexico, and I knew that if I talked to someone, they would take me seriously. They weren't going to say, oh, it's another gringo. We're not going to talk to him. There's that getting respect that way was very helpful. It, in terms of helping my morale, it was great. So this is a book about, I suppose, you want to lift your morale, get in a car, drive somewhere, drive around a country where people respect older people, and you'll be happy.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The interesting thing about that experience is that when travel is offered to people as they get older, I'm just in middle age and I'm starting to see this kind of marketing. What you're told is that you should remove all the friction from your possible trip and make things as simple as possible. And you're giving us the exact opposite message.
Friction is the essence of a travel book. Friction, conflict, things going wrong. People said to me, isn't it terrible that you had such a bad time with the Mexican police? I said, that's a blessing. I found out about the police. I found out something about myself. I felt vulnerable. I felt helpless. And that's what you write about. Anyone who thinks that they can go to the south of France and write about Marseille or, you know, Nice or Cannes in the sunshine and the great food is wrong. No one wants to read that. No one wants to read about, I had this just perfectly marvelous trip, you know, Eat, Pray, Love. I know people read it, but that's not my kind of book. Mine is, what is the country really like? What is the conflict really like? So the gift to a traveler, not a tourist. A tourist is not looking for rough edges. Tourist has a week or 10 days. They need everything to go smoothly. And that's a good thing. But they're not going to come back with a book. A traveler is someone who doesn't know quite where they're going, and when things go wrong, they have something to report back on. My book is not about things going wrong, but it's about seeing what the Zen master Suzuki said, seeing life exactly as it is, because freedom is seeing things as they are, not as they should be, not, you know, the Dickensian London, but to see things, or Mexico as the rough edges, to see things as they are, and to have these experiences that are formative.
You keep talking about how old you are, but you are like the youngest late 70s person that I've encountered in a very long time. One thing that you do have to be realistic about is what if at some point in the next few years your eyesight doesn't allow you to drive your own car these distances? How much do you think about that? How much do you let yourself think about that?
It's a big worry. You know, you're touching on something that I think about all the time. When you get to a certain age, you think about, I mean, there's a wonderful story by V.S. Pritchett where an old man is has a young wife, and she says, what are you thinking about? And he says, you. But then he says, but what he was really thinking about was death. Hmm. And so we don't have a lot of time. I was talking to an old schoolmate of mine, a very wealthy man. He just called up, and we were talking, and we found ourselves talking about aging and the idea of not being able to drive, or being, you know, stuck at home or needing someone to take me around. Yeah, it's very annoying. It'll happen. It happens to everybody. But as long as I'm spared, I would like to be active, healthy. I gave up smoking in 1981. That was a good decision. And I'm still pretty active. I do yoga. I do exercise. I swim. I live in Hawaii half the year. I have nothing to complain about. But I would like to be flexible and healthy. And I was noticing the other day that I was thinking about John Updike, who was, I knew vaguely, very prolific and a wonderful writer and a good guy. He died when he was 76. I'm 78. But then Jesse Jackson is 78. Martha Stewart's 78. Dick Cheney's 78. We're all, you know, it's Bob Dylan is 78.
78 is not what it used to be.
No, it's not what it used to be. And these guys, they're all different. You know, Ryan O'Neill, he's 78. I keep
you've got a tally of all the 78-year-olds.
I have a tally of everyone my age. And I think, are they going to get in a car and go to Mexico? Probably not. But I'm going to.
Paul Theroux's newest book is On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. Paul, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time to spend with us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure to be here.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink, and we hope that you will use your favorite podcast app to subscribe to our podcast. If you'd like to learn about upcoming shows, check our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.